So, Belshazzar, the writing on the wall, and then if we get lucky, the lion's den as well. We jumped from Nebuchadnezzar to King Belshazzar. Belshazzar, who is either the son or grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. We noted that there was another king in between, Evil-Merodach. And Belshazzar makes a big feast, which is during a battle against the Persians and the Medes, the Persian king Cyrus, the Mede Darius. And he makes a big party, and he is a drinker. There are 1,000 officers there, and he drinks as much as all of them. We saw Vashti mocking Ahasuerus for the fact that Belshazzar is able to hold his drink, whereas Ahasuerus is not. And in the course of this, feast, a hand comes out. And this is not a dream. This is not like the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar. This is actually a vision that everybody at the party is having. They see a disembodied hand writing on the wall. And the we don't know what the writing is at this stage. We're going to find out. But they call the advisors, right? Belshazzar is terribly frightened. And they call the advisors and want the advisors to explain. Belshazzar, unlike Nebuchadnezzar, tries the carrot rather than the stick. He says, anybody who can explain this, I will give him wonderful benefits. And doesn't work. And then out comes either the queen or the queen mother and says, you know, there was this fellow named Daniel. And in Nebuchadnezzar's time, Daniel was able to explain everything. So you should really ask him to explain this to you. And we talked about why Belshazzar doesn't know about Daniel. It is two kings later, but not that many years have passed. It seems, frankly, more like this is a willing ignorance. This is, I don't want to know about Daniel, like Asher lo yada as Yosef. It's also possible, though, that Daniel is now living in Shushan, because we're going to find him there later in the book. So it's also possible that he moved out. He's gone. He's ancient history. They don't even know that he's still alive, necessarily. But however you read the ignorance of Daniel, the queen or queen mother says, we should really call him. And that's what they do. And that brings us to Perek Hei Pasuk Yud Gimel, chapter 5, sentence 13. See that? You can get right back into the story. Beidayin. At that point, Daniel hu al kadamalka. Daniel was brought before the king. Ani malka ba'amar le Daniel, and the king declared and said to Daniel, "Antu Daniel, you're Daniel." I know, but okay, it's the way kings talk. You are Daniel di min b'nei galusa di Yehud. You are from the Judean exile. Di haisi malka avi min Yehud, which my father, which again doesn't have to be father, could be predecessor, could be grandfather, brought from among the Jews. V'shemeis alach, alach, I heard about you. V'ruach alayin bach, that you have the spirit of the gods in you. V'nahiru v'sach l'sanu v'chach mayatira hishtichachas bach. And there is insight in you, you have great wisdom. And you know, I had all these advisors brought before me to read this text, to fishrei lahod usani, and tell me what it means. And they can't explain it. This is like the story of Daniel's life, right? You bring out Daniel, you tell him, the advisors can't do anything, can you help? And he says, sure. And he goes off and helps. You have to wonder what Daniel thinks of the quality of these advisors, that none of them are able to assist. But alright. Va'ana shimei salach, the sequel fishrin the mifshar, v'kidrin the mishrei. I've heard that you are able to give explanations. I've heard that you were able to untie knots, so to speak. Ka'an hein tikul ksava le mikre, u'fishrei lahoda usani. So now you could read this text and you could tell me what it means. Argavana silbash, you will wear purple, which is royal garb, exactly. And you will have the golden necklace around your neck. And you will reign over one third of the kingdom, which I think we explained last week, doesn't mean literally I'm giving you one third of the kingdom. It likely means that, as we'll see later in the book, having three officers, each one who would be in charge of part of the kingdom, so you'll become one of the big three. You'll become one of my three key ministers. That's what he offers him. So now it's Daniel's turn. Pasuk Yud Zayin. Beit Dayin at that point, Ane Daniel va'amar kada malka. Daniel responds to the king. Matnasach lach lehevyan. He says, you can keep your presence, he says to him. Unavaz biyasach la'acharon hav. Give your spoils to somebody else, he says. Yeah, this is not the sort of thing you could ever say to Nebuchadnezzar. You said this to Nebuchadnezzar was the last thing you were ever going to say. But he says to Belshazzar, you can keep your presence. Thanks a lot. Bram, however, ksava ekre lamalka. I will read the text for the king. Ufishra adaho diine, and I will tell him the explanation. We're at Perakei Pasuk Yuches, 5:18. So I'm going to explain it, but I'm not interested in your presence. Why in the world is he refusing the presence of Belshazzar? What's he doing here? It's not like he refused Nebuchadnezzar's gifts. Now again, maybe it's because with Nebuchadnezzar, that literally would be the last thing you ever said. And to do it in the way that he did it is not really like, it's not a respectful declining. Like if someone's going to give you something and you don't really want it, you can hand it off to somebody else. You could find some way to get out of it. Like, this is very in your face. This is like, you know, give that to somebody else. I'm not interested. So, why? Why does he take this tack with Belshazzar? What do we know about Belshazzar? Yeah?
Oh, I wasn't going to say about Belshazzar, but like, isn't this, there's precedent for this? Like, when Avram, the king of stone, he also, like, says, I don't want anything from you after, like...
Right.
That's, it's not a foreign concept for
right.
not to want to take things.
Dead.
Right, but he took gifts from Nebuchadnezzar. He didn't like food.
Or food.
Food he refused. But he took gifts. When Nebuchadnezzar, after the first time he explained the dream, Nebuchadnezzar gave him status and he gave him wealth and all that, and Daniel said, thank you.
Or he knew with this one you could talk like this. This is a different mentality. It's not as the way you just
So what is there about Belshazzar that would tell you that this is going to be any different? I think you're on the right track.
He didn't threaten him. Like the way
he didn't threaten him.
He offered nice things instead of killing him. Yeah.
So he offered nice things, therefore I can be rude.
Well...
Yeah. I mean,
no, he doesn't want him to think that he's interpreting it for the presence. But then Nebuchadnezzar, your life depended on it, and then the presence came later.
That's a good point. Nebuchadnezzar only offered the gifts after he acted. So he doesn't want it to look like he's, you know, for hire, so to speak. You find that in some of the Nevi'im. Amos, actually, is a good example of that, where Amos, there's a Kohen Gadol named Amatzia, who's corrupt. And Amatzia says to Amos, when Amos is predicting the downfall of the king and people are corrupt and so forth, so Amos's reaction, so Amatzia says to Amos, you should go prophesy for your bread elsewhere. Like, you know, you give these messages expecting that somebody's going to feed you. And so maybe that's it. Maybe this is because the offer is made before the interpretation. That's why he feels like he doesn't want to... that he doesn't want to be seen as explaining it for the sake of the food. That could be, or the gift, I should say. Take a look at source number one, please. I'll give you an idea from Abarbanel. He offers two approaches. Although I like the idea that it's pre the explanation. Take a look at what Abarbanel does. He says, Shemizulas matanosav hayamuchan la'avdo v'lasos ritzono. Even without the gifts, he's ready to serve and he's going to do what he's supposed to do. In other words, it's really not rude. It's actually meant to say that even without the presents, I'll still do it. You don't need to pay me for it. Alternatively, Daniel did it because he wanted to rebuke him openly, meaning that what he is going to say to Belshazzar is going to be harsh. And so this is sort of, you know, like, I can't really take, you know, your gifts because what I'm going to say is not going to make you very happy. You'll see what he's about to predict. It's his downfall, essentially. But I think there's something else going on here that relates to Belshazzar's identity. The relationship in general between Daniel and Belshazzar is very different from the relationship between Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar. And it's going to play out in the way that he gives the explanation. So maybe we'll read more in terms of what's actually happening and we'll see what Daniel says to him and how he says it. And you'll see the differences between the way that Daniel speaks to Belshazzar and he speaks to Nebuchadnezzar, and that will give us perhaps another layer to this. So let's go back into the psukim. We are at Pasuk Yud Ches, sentence 18. Ant Malka, you, O King. Elaka Ilah Malchusa Ravusa Vikarva Hadra Yahavla Nebuchadnezzar Ravuch. He says, you know, God gave great power, the throne, honor, glory to Nebuchadnezzar, your father. Umin Ravusa Diahavle Kol Amamaya Umaya Blishanaya Havozoin Vedachlin Min Kadamohi. And from the status that God gave to him, all of the nations, all of the languages and so on, they all trembled before him. Diabatsabe Havakatel. Whoever he wished, he killed. Vidiyavatsave Havamache. If he wanted to give someone life, he gave him life. Vidiyavatsave Havamarim. Those he wished, he elevated. Vidiyavatsave Havamashpil. Whoever he wished, he lowered. Is he talking about Nebuchadnezzar or Hashem? Right, you think about the language that he's using. Right, it sounds a lot like Nisana Tokev. It really does. And it sounds like phrases that we use regarding Hashem. Regarding even phrases that Nebuchadnezzar used about Hashem. So you could really read the sentence, I think, in multiple ways. You could read the sentence as describing how Hashem's power is, or you could read it as, no, this is what Hashem did for Nebuchadnezzar. He gave Nebuchadnezzar everything, and now Nebuchadnezzar wanted to kill somebody, he did it. He wanted to give someone life, he did it. Whatever it was, Nebuchadnezzar could do whatever he wished. However, the next pasuk makes it clear that this is in fact Nebuchadnezzar. Uchdirim levavei viruchei tikfas lahazada. However, when his heart became lofty, he became arrogant. And when his spirit became strong in doing cruel things, Hanchas min karse malchuse, he was lowered from his throne. Vikara hediv mine, and God removed his honor from him. In other words, God gave it to Nebuchadnezzar, and he gave him everything. He could be whoever he wanted to be, do whatever he wanted to do. Once Nebuchadnezzar crossed some invisible line, at that point, God removed it from him. Umin b'nei anasha tirid, he was chased out from among people. And this is all what we saw in Perek Dalet. V'libaveyim chevsa shavi, how to read that one? I believe it's shavi. They haven't slung in the dot mikra. They noted it as shaviv in the Kri.
Yes,
okay. And his heart was with the beasts. V'im aradayim idorei, he lived with the arodim. Arodim are some kind of wild donkey. Isba kisari yitamune, he ate grass like the oxen, umital shemaya gishme yitzdaba, and from the dew and the rain he became wet, ad diyadadi shalit elaka ila b'malchus anasha, to the point where he knew that Hashem controls everything in the kingdom of human beings, ulamandi yitzbeya hakeim Allah, and whoever he wishes he appoints. Ve'ant berei Belshazzar, and you are his son, grandson, successor, whatever, Belshazzar. Lash bel libavach. You have not humbled your heart. Kol kavel dichol dina yedanta. Even though you know what happened to Nebuchadnezzar, you're aware, and you didn't learn. V'amare shemaya hisro mamta. And instead, you have been lofty yourself over the God of the heavens. And here's the key. Ulamanaya divayse haisiv kadamach. You brought the vessels of his house before yourself for your feast. You did what we read about last week, right? You brought out the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash. Even Nebuchadnezzar didn't dare to do that. Nebuchadnezzar, who had taken the vessels, put them away in storage, right? Maybe a break front somewhere or something, I don't know. But he didn't drink out of them. You had this feast with your 1,000 officers, and you brought them out and you drank from them. He says, now you're in trouble. You and your officers and the wives and the concubines, you're all drinking wine out of them. And you praised gods of gold and silver and iron and wood and stone, gods who neither see nor hear. And you did not honor the God who holds your soul in his hands. And everything that you do is dependent on this. Good Rosh Hashanah reading. He says, boy, did you make a mistake. That's his statement. Haven't explained the text yet, but now he gets to the writing on the wall. But now maybe I understand a little bit more about why he doesn't want to take the presents. In other words, he's going to take his gold. He's going to take the purple and so forth in order to give him Musar. even before he's gotten to explaining anything, he's given him, I don't know if you'd call it free advice exactly, but he's certainly telling him where he's gone wrong. Yeah.
Like, is the Nandi really supposed to be doing all this? Like, why is he giving him mustard for something that, like, I don't know, like, are we supposed to be going to, like, every king of every nation being like, well, you didn't, like, respect our God, so you're being punished right now?
What do you think? Thinking about the Torah and about what the what, you know, what happens with foreign kings in Torah in general. Paro. Right? Paro would be one.
Yeah, but Paro is because
of the hostage.
So Paro wasn't saving us.
A random king in a random land.
Don't
all
the Nubians do that? They all score the non-Jewish nations.
So some of them do. But yeah, it's true that it's generally punishment for you did this to the Jews, whereas Belshazzar inherited it. Mm-hmm. And we don't know of anything in terms of his relationship with the Jews. It really does seem to be more about his personal character and his personal act with the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash. Part of it may be because it's the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash.
But how's he supposed to know that? Like, to us it's precious, but like he probably went around doing that to every nation and using all their vessels, and like he wasn't thinking like, well, I'll use the Jewish ones because they're...
Well, no, he did try them.
Unless it was like deliberately to humiliate them or to...
But even so, he's going to humiliate every nation he takes over. Like, to us, it's like, oh my gosh, they're the base of Mitzvah vessels. But, like, to him, it's like...
And also, it really makes me think that still what Nebuchadnezzar did was worse. Like, he's not harming people. He's just...
So one way to look at it is you have Sheva Mitzvos B'nai Noach, right? And one of the Sheva Mitzvos B'nai Noach for all human beings is to recognize God and not worship Avodah Zarah. Now, by the time you get to Belshazzar, how aware are they of these mitzvahs? Probably not at all. For him to be cognizant of it. Nonetheless, there is an expectation for humanity that they are supposed to come around to the idea that there is a creator. They are supposed to recognize that there's a God, and that you know, this God is above all the petty gods that they've developed out of the thunder and the lightning and rain and whatever else. And what he's getting here is not so much punishment yet. We haven't seen punishment. What we've seen is education. Right. We're getting to the punishment part. Realistically, in terms of the... Well, let's read what happens and then come back to it, because I'm not sure it should be read as punishment for this act. So we'll first see the explanation of the text, of what was actually written on the wall, and then come back to the question and look at it again. So, Pasuk Chav Dalet. Beidayin, at that point, min kadamoi shliach pasa diyida, from before him, the hand, this disembodied hand, was sent forth, uchsava dina rishim, and it made this text on the wall, udina ksava di rishim, and this is the text. Minei, minei, tekel, ufarsin. Four words. Minei, minei, tekel, ufarsin. What in the world does that mean? So, it's actually Aramaic, is what it is. And now he explains the text. Dinak Sharmilsa, this is the explanation of it. Mina elaka malchusach behashlema. Mina is like minyan. What does minyan mean? No, what does it mean? Count. Minyan is a count. Right? Limnot is to count. So, Minei is Mina Elaka Malchusach. God has counted your reign, Vahashlama, and he has completed it. In other words, Babel is over. You're done, exactly. Tekel, you know what Tekel is. Tough in Aramaic becomes Shin in Hebrew.
To weigh.
Like Shekel, exactly. Tekelta vimoznaya, you have been weighed on the scale, v'hishtechachat chasir, and you have been found lacking. Oh dear. You've been weighed and you came up light.
It's like Rosh Hashanah again.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it is. And then parsin, pares, prisas malhusach vihavas vihivas, I should say, l'madayu foras. Lifros is to split. Your reign or your empire has been split and given to the Persians and the Medes. You're done, Belshazzar, is what he says. Now, we have to get to Belshazzar's response to this explanation, but first we have to ask a pretty serious question. This is Aramaic.
Why couldn't they read it?
Yeah, what's wrong with them? Like, why couldn't they read this text? So two explanations. Sorry?
They didn't understand. They could be there, but they didn't understand what it meant.
Why wouldn't they understand what it meant? I mean,
count, wave,
and split. Count, wave, split. Okay, so maybe, yeah, it's not so clear. I hear that. The Josephus' approach is, I couldn't find it in Josephus, but Barbanel quotes it. Take a look at source number 2. Yes. Now, is that where? I just want to make sure I've got the right one there. But I believe it is. Okay, let's see what it says. Hine, tia chachmas Daniel ha-chachmi Bavel v'shnei dvarim yachad. Daniel's wisdom exceeded that of the chachamim of Bavel in two ways at once. Im b'yidias ha-kriya, shehem lo ha-yodim likros osios ivrios. Right. He says, first of all, it was written not in the usual alphabet, but in Hebrew letters. Now, what is he talking about? In what way are their letters different from our letters? Aramaic's written in alphabet also.
Not the original. Yeah. Our Babylonian.
No, they were using the same alphabet.
Our alphabet?
Yeah. It wasn't ours. Our Aleph Beis is actually Ashurit. Our Aleph Beis is Assyrian. We close the recorder. We didn't invent the Aleph Beis.
Hashem gave the Torah.
Right. So that's the big question: is what are you talking about? What is this different alphabet? What alphabet was used on the Luchos?
Ancient.
Correct. What's known by scholars in the field as Paleo-Semitic. There's an original Hebrew alphabet. It's not the alphabet that you're used to in your Tanakh. The machlokas in the Gemara, this is not news, this is a Gemara. The machlokas in the Gemara is at what point the switch was made and which alphabet was used when. So, for example, the Gemara mentions that there's a medrash that says that the letters on the luchos were actually engraved straight through. Miraculously, the letters went straight through but were readable on both sides, which doesn't make any sense, but that's the point, it's a miracle. But the question is, this Medrash says that the Mem and the Samach, Mem, we assume means Mem Sofit, and the Samach hung in the air. Right? Because if you engrave a Samach straight through, what happens to the middle? It should drop. So the Gemara says that it stays like that. Well, the problem is that the Gemara also has a view that we only start using this alphabet in the days of Ezra. After Daniel, beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash, which would explain what we're talking about here, but leave this story for a second. The point is that means that the Luchos are written in an alphabet that's different, and if you look, we have that original alphabet, it's not a mystery. If you look at it, that line about the Mem and the Samach standing miraculously in the Luchos doesn't work now.
Don't we have that every Sefer Torah is copied from a previous Sefer Torah?
Yeah.
So how does it work if you change the alphabet?
So the idea that the Gemara puts forth is that Ezra was the one who actively changed it. In other words,
So he made a new Sefer Torah and he switched over all the letters.
Right. And we actually have texts that go back to that time. Think like Dead Sea Scrolls. Not Ezra's time, but a few centuries later, which are written in the new Aleph base, except the four-letter name of Hashem is written in Paleo-Semitic.
Which is what?
And this older
alphabet.
Oh, so the letters aren't that far off. Some of them are angled differently. Some of them have an extra line in them. They look like they were a lot easier for people who were not writing with ink. Because they're more right angles.
Why was it changed? The Torah doesn't usually change in the
Quran. So then the question is, what was the reason for changing it? What's going on? So one view is that this new alphabet that we have was actually the original intended alphabet. And that now we were returning to what Hashem had wanted. In other words, the alphabet that we have, that you're familiar with, was what God wanted in the first place. And then the question is, then why didn't we have it the whole time, right? Why were we out of it at some point? Were we growing Kedusha, whatever, but that's one view of, frankly, several about why we evolved in terms of the Aleph Beis that we were using.
This is what Hashem wanted, but the Luchot weren't in the language that Hashem wanted.
So that's one view. One view is that the Luchos actually were in the original. The Luchos were in what is now called Ashurit, the Assyrian alphabet. But the Jews generally didn't use that.
Is it only letter for letter that's different, or it's the whole language?
No, the language is the same.
It's just like yelling out.
Correct.
So the
Vayikra with a small aleph, whatever that was. Although you know that was a small aleph too?
Correct. Although you know that Rashi didn't make up Rashi's alphabet either.
Who did?
Okay. The Rashi script was likely never used by Rashi. I apologize.
All like suffer through the Rashi script with their kids.
What happens is, if you go back, if you go back to those times, there were two reasons why, well, three reasons why, you had various kinds of shorthand forms of making the letters that were created. One reason was the block letters that we are familiar with take up a lot of space. Whereas those letters, the Rashi script letters, they're a lot more curved, and therefore you can fit them into a narrower area, and therefore you don't use as much writing material, that your parchment paper, whatever you're using at that point, it's a lot easier to fit them in. Number two is that it's a lot faster to write them. If you're trying to write quickly, and remember, you're pre-printing press, you have to sit there writing all this out, you can, once you're good at it, I mean, if you learned block letters, and then afterwards you're retrained in Rashi letters, it's harder to do until you become used to it. But it's a lot faster as a text to write curved letters than to write letters that have angles to them. So that's a second reason.
Rashi wasn't like, you know, rushed, like he wrote so cursively.
He wrote so much though.
I'm going to come back to what Rashi wrote in. Hang on. But the third explanation is that it was to differentiate between that which is holy and then the commentaries that are being written. Like, it will be hubris if I have a Gemara here to put my commentary in the margins. Like, who am I that I'm going to start, you know, sending this out? So at least let me differentiate and show I get it. I'm not writing Gemara. What I'm doing is just providing an explanation for people, and therefore I'll use a different script to denote that. All three reasons are valid, and all three reasons actually were invoked for having a different alphabet. The reason I say that Rashi did not use this is because it's been traced back. There were various kinds of shorthand used in the Italian communities, in the French communities, and so forth. And the script that we know as Rashi's script wasn't in France at that time. They just weren't using it in Rashi's day. Then why do we call it Rashi's script? Because when they started to publish Rashi's commentaries, the printing presses used that script. So it was a script that was used to print Rashi. It wasn't Rashi wrote Rashi's script.
What about the script that we use now?
Sorry, it's historically accurate. If you want, I can send you all sorts of material on it.
What about the script that we use now? You know, the aleph like this.
You mean the curve that we have?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know who invented that. Don't know.
See, but the original Torah that Moshe wrote the first time.
Yes.
Which alphabet did he use?
Locus. It's
not
Locus.
What language?
Yeah. Sorry? It was Hebrew. It was, the language was the same. The only question is what alphabet is in use.
So why couldn't there be the writing on the wall?
So now we're going back to this. What Barbanel is floating here, and in the part that I skipped in the ellipsis at some point, I think. In any case, he says that this is Josephus' idea, is that the letters that were being used were our letters, but the Babylonians were using Ketav Ashurit. They're using the Assyrian alphabet, and therefore they couldn't read it.
That's one of the machlokas. There's a machlokas whether the Torah was written like the Sefer Torah, and then they went back to it, or everyone agrees that's not the way it was written.
Nothing is clear about this whole. Everything is subject to machlokas in terms of our history of using the different alphabets. When we use the Assyrian alphabet and when we use the Paleo-Semitic alphabet, there are multiple viewpoints on it. If I had thought about it, I would prepare something for today on it because it's a good topic to know about. But I have to go back and look at my own notes.
Sure.
It's a straight Gemara in Megillah. It's not.
A lot of
it
later, for sure.
Yeah, no, I'll send you something later on it, but it's Megillah Daf Tes, I think. Is where this is discussed. But Barbanel's first explanation is they don't know that alphabet, and that's why they can't understand it, even though the language is Aramaic. In other words, once he reads it aloud and says, Mene, Mene, oh, now I know what it says. Although, as Rudy points out, so what? Now you can read the words. What does it mean? So keep on reading in Barbanel. He says, that's only one possibility. The im, where in the Hebrew, at the end of the first line in the Hebrew, in the English, it's and in knowledge of. V'im b'idiyas ha'perush. Or alternatively, Daniel was greater than them in terms of knowing the explanation. He says the explanation is still hidden, you know, even though you can read the words. And in order to hint at the two ways in which he informed them, both what do the letters say and what do they mean, the material, meaning what are the letters, and the form, Amar, this is what he said, Dinak Sava Vigomer, he said, this is the text, I'm telling you what the words say, and Udinak Pishra Di Milsa, this is the explanation of it. Because really, Daniel could have told him the words and then explained it in a way that sounded good for Belshazzar and bad for the Persians. And that what it really means is that the Persians are going to die, the Elchu Beshivya, and they'll be taken captive. He could have just as easily said that, you know, Minyan Godol Mehem. Oh, he's actually explaining the words. Mine, right, means great numbers. And then he's saying mine, and then tekel, to be weighed, v'yishkelu kasvam v'zahavam b'shalal, they'll take their silver and gold. The shkol is also to take. So we'll take their silver and gold. Parson is the Persians. So he could have interpreted this in a diametrically opposite way. Instead of saying this means I've counted Babylon and they're done, right? And their kingdom is going to be split between the Persians and the Medes. Instead, he could have read it to say the great numbers of Persians are going to be taken captive and destroyed.
That would have happened.
Right, it wouldn't have been true, but his point is, the fact that I told you how to read the words isn't sufficient. There's actually a second thing that I'm giving you in this. So that's the other approach that that Abarbanel offers.
But Belshazzar could just not take his approach.
Yeah.
Like, if I was him, I wouldn't believe it.
Well, let's see what happens. We haven't seen his reaction yet.
Belshazzar and, you know, the history, but
right.
Once you read the words, it's like it's open to interpretation.
Right. I mean, there's sort of the sense, maybe, that sort of once you hire the contractor, you're pretty much locked in. Like, you brought him in, you know? You brought him in because he's an expert. He knows what he's doing, you know?
Also, I'm sure that MS, like, resonated the same, like, with Carl, no?
It's possible. The question is, how sensitive is Belshazzar to that? And I don't know. But let's see, we're going to see what happens. You know, the story's still playing out. But first, I want to show you the Gemara, which gives you a different explanation for why they couldn't read it. It doesn't go into the alphabet discussion. Amar Rav. Rav says, Begematria ichtiv lahon. It was written for them in Gematria. I didn't translate this because it's untranslatable. That's why I didn't give you an English for this. It was written in Gematria. Now, not Gematria the way we usually use the word Gematria. Gematria is not a Hebrew word, right? You know it's Greek. It's Giana. Oh, come on.
Is there anything to read about?
I felt terrible. It's bad. Gematria is geometry, right? And you know. Okay, so it's a reference here, the way that Rav uses the word in the Gemara, it's a reference to ways of playing with letters and as you see here, yitat idach hug chamt is his first explanation. What in the world did Rav just do? How did he get this code from Mene to Kelufarsin?
Same letters.
What do you
mean? I mean,
the
same number.
Oh, it's Akbash.
I saw you wrote
last time. Yes, you saw it on the sheet last time. Okay, that's fine.
I just remember now. Yeah. I thought I was in the
back. It is Akbash, right? I took it off the sheet because I wanted to fit everything.
It was
everything
on the last sheet, yeah.
Yes. But now I wanted to fit everything on one double-sided page. So the answer is, indeed, Atbash. Atbash is a system in which the letters of the alphabet are paired up, the first with the 22nd, the second with the 21st, the third with the 20th, and so on. So in other words, Aleph and Taf are paired, Bet and Shin are paired, Gimel and Reish are paired, Dalet and work your way backwards, thank you, Kuf are paired, and so on within the alphabet. The most famous use of Atbash is probably the Yom Tov use. Pesach, right? The 7 days of biblical Pesach are each numbered. Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hei, Vav, Zayin. You can figure out the day of the week that all the other special days on our calendar will come out using Atbash. This is just strange, but it's true. Meaning, Aleph is the first day of Pesach. the same day of the week as the first day of Pesach will also be Tav, which is Tisha B'Av. Not like Tet, the number, but Tisha B'Av, writing down Tavshin. Yes. So in other words, if the first day of Pesach is going to be a Tuesday, then Tisha B'Av is going to be a Tuesday that year. It always works. This is where a calendar is built. The and then Bet is Shin. The second day of Pesach will always be the same day of the week as Shavuos. Now that has to happen anyway because it's Sfiras HaOmer. That's built in.
How do we know which Shmini Atzeret?
So you have to know how your Rabash works. It actually works the whole way through. The Gimel and the Dalet and so on. The Gimel is right. The third day of Pesach is Rosh Hashanah. And the What was the kuf on it? I was going to stop there. I don't remember now what each of them is.
Wait, when he says the mantra, it's referring to Akbash, not actually counting.
Well, Akbash is a system of gematria, of coding letters.
Does that mean anything?
Well, Akbash literally is Aleph Tav Bet Shin. That's what Akbash means.
Right, and the gematria doesn't mean the numbers. The
right,
so equivalent to the letters.
Correct. He's saying that it just means general coding of letters. Correct. So yeah, the you have one from last time.
Yeah.
I seem to remember my rabbi when I was growing up telling us that the seventh one, the seventh day of Pesach is the same day as Yom Ha'atzmaut, the Ayin in Ha'atzmaut. That's what my rabbi told us growing up. I never checked it. But so he said. Okay. In any case, Ushmuel Omar, Shmuel gives a different explanation. He says, Mamtus Nankafi Ha'alran, which I gave you in source number 4, so you can see how he did that. Shmuel says the letters are written vertically instead of horizontally.
Why would it be the Akbash?
So the Mem is Yud. When you use the Akbash method, Mem.
Nobody says the
translation. This one is actually Tekel, and so on.
Oh, saying that's what it said. Okay.
Yeah, that's the idea.
But the last two.
Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Anam Anam. You can see what he did, obviously. He just, no. The Rabbi Yochanan just did backwards. Each word backwards. And Ravashi Amar, Nema Nema Kitel Kursin, is sort of like a pig Latin type of a thing. He just reversed the first and second letter. And that's it. It's only the first and second letter that are flipped.
What do these all mean?
So they have no independent meaning whatsoever. They're just ways to write Mene Mene Tekel Kursin in code. Different ways that the code could have appeared.
None of the advisors can figure this out.
Well, the thing is,
you don't know what it means. You can't.
It's not just that you don't know what it means, although that's true. But even if they hit on the right words, they wouldn't necessarily know they had hit on the right words because those words could mean anything.
So you're saying this is what the hand wrote? These are their opinions?
Correct.
And that's how
Daniel told them this is what it is. Yeah, why the Gemara wants to spend so much time on what the code was is a good question. I don't have an answer. Interestingly, Rembrandt, when he did his Belshazzar's feast, Rembrandt did a whole bunch of paintings of things from Tanakh. He has a beautiful, I don't know if beautiful is the right word, it's like haunting really, painting of Yirmiyahu after the Horban, the desolation of Yirmiyahu. So he has one called Belshazzar's feast, in which he does the writing on the wall, and he follows Shmuel's view that it's written vertically. Someone must have explain them from Shmuel's perspective. So, why is Mene written twice? Right? It should just be Mene. I counted, and that's it. So, Abarbanel suggests that it's because it's a double count. And this is going to take us back to the question of, is he being punished for use of the vessels that you asked before? It's a count of the destruction of Babylon, but it's also a count of the rescue of the Jews. Meaning, this isn't necessarily about the downfall of Babel, and we're going to punish Belshazzar for using the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash. That's just, you know, Daniel throwing that in. But fundamentally, it's about the end of our exile, because the arc from here is going to lead to Koresh becoming king over the Jewish exiles and allowing them to come back to build the second Beis HaMikdash. So we're just following, you know, a path that has been set. Even if Belshazzar never brings out these vessels at the feast, his end is coming regardless. The only question is, will it be gentle or will it be mean? But he's done. And so I think that's an important point to remember when we ask the question of, was he responsible to know not to use these vessels? The answer is maybe, maybe not. I mean, I would like to think still that there's a certain, you know, dignity he would accord to his enemies, even though he doesn't, you know, worship it and so on. But aside from that, he's done anyway. To a large extent. So that's the message. But I want to come back to now having read what this message is that he's giving and the harshness of it. Daniel's relationship with Nebuchadnezzar versus Daniel's relationship with Belshazzar. Daniel is now done speaking. He has finished the conversation. I mean, he hasn't finished the conversation because Belshazzar is going to respond, but he has finished what he has to say. How is this different from the way he addressed Nebuchadnezzar when he had a vision of Nebuchadnezzar's downfall?
He gave him advice.
Right, he didn't give him advice when he told him about his kingdom ultimately collapsing. When he said that you'll be replaced by this and by this and by this. There he didn't give him advice, so that's worth noting. But I think that with Nebuchadnezzar, he accepted gifts. When he said something terrible was going to happen to Nebuchadnezzar personally, he said, you know, this should happen to your enemies. He said, here's advice for you to delay it. And with Nebuchadnezzar, he credited Hashem at the start of his advice. Right? When he told Nebuchadnezzar the meaning of the visions, he said, you know, God says the following thing, wisdom comes from God. Daniel didn't do that here. Now, there are different explanations I think you could offer for why, but Rabbi Yaakov Meidan, who I've quoted before, says that Belshazzar doesn't have the respect of Daniel. Belshazzar is, as we've already shown, he's a drunk, he's partying with his friends, he's treating the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash with disrespect. He's a people pleaser, right? Nebuchadnezzar doesn't care what people think. You know, as long as they obey, he's good with it. And he's brutal. Belshazzar is like, you know, please will you help me? I'll give you treasure. It will be nice. And so Daniel refuses the gift and doesn't treat him with respect, much more like Abraham with the king of Sodom, who Abraham does not respect. You know, it's worth noting, Abraham rejects the gifts of the king of Sodom.
But he takes power.
But he takes power's gifts. Right? I think the rejection of the king of Sodom may have to do with who he is and his character and the character of the community he leads.
He doesn't need his gifts of power because he didn't have anything at that
point. Hashem has promised him that he's going to give him. Right, and that could be a response. But the fact that he says, I'm going to do it that way, and he doesn't, you know, reject it, I think that says something.
Do you know how old
Daniel
is
now? No. I mean, we had this debate in the beginning of the Sefer in the first place as to how old he is.
But then he's a youth, right?
Right, he's definitely not a youth anymore.
Maybe he's just old and he talks short.
Maybe.
He's an old man now.
Maybe. Maybe. Well, that's Daniel's explanation. So let's see what happens. We still have a little bit of time. Pasuk Chaf Tes. Beidayin, at that point, Amar Belshazzar v'halbishu l'Daniel argivana v'hamicha didava al tzavre. Belshazzar decrees, and they give Daniel the purple clothing, they give him the golden necklace, v'achrizu aloi dilehevi shalit talta b'malchusa, and he makes him the officer in charge of one-third of the kingdom. That's a point in favor of Belshazzar.
He
stuck to his word, and not only that, he did it immediately.
And he was told that he doesn't have to, and he was told bad things.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, this is a point in his favor. Nonetheless, Be'belelya ketil Belshazzar malka kazda'a. Nonetheless, Belshazzar was killed that night.
But Daniel accepted the gift? Doesn't want it.
Apparently. By the Persians and Medes. They broke through their invasion, and they killed him. Yeah.
Right away, right after.
They were in a siege. Yeah.
They're writing the guard wall.
Yeah.
Wow. Wasn't there a story here? Am I missing it up? Ran away, hid somewhere, and they...
No, Belshazzar doesn't get away.
He's done.
I don't know. But no, Belshazzar's done. Yeah.
That doesn't give any information how he's killed.
We know he's killed by the Medes and the Persians.
They were so focused on this writing on the wall, like there's people swarming your siege, like...
They're
going to kill you. Go, you see?
Well, keep in mind, what were they doing before they had the hand right on the walls? They were having a big feast while they're under siege. In other words, Belshazzar is very much the king who wants to show everything is okay, everything's going to be fine. So there's a siege, and he is going to throw a big party to demonstrate, I'm not afraid, which is good until they come in and, you know, it's too late.
Kill him. Yeah. Also, they don't know what else to do, you know? Like, we give up this party.
Is it an abandonment of hope? I don't know. But the real postscript to this comes in Sefer Ezra. So some of you have Tanakh in front of you. Take a look, please, at the beginning of Sefer Ezra. And you'll see what the Persians did. The very beginning of the Sefer. Right? So the very beginning, and I'll use that as a sales pitch. On Tuesday afternoons, I'll be teaching Sefer Ezra after Yom Tov at Shari Shammai.
What time?
1:30.
Say a plug for this year, too.
Yeah. So you'll be seeing these Pesukim again. So what happens with the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash in the beginning of Ezra? It's in Hebrew, not Aramaic.
Okay, got it.
Or actually, is it? The beginning of Sefer Ezra, what happens with the vessels in the Beis HaMikdash? Koresh declares that they can build the Beis HaMikdash, and he gives them the vessels back. He gives them the vessels. In other words, I said this a little bit last week. The vessels of the Beis HaMikdash matter a great deal. It isn't just another facet of going into exile. It mattered when the Babylonians took them in the first place. Tanakh took the trouble of mentioning that they're going to go. Yirmiyahu had a nevuah. Yirmiyahu's nevuah was, Bavela Yuvu, they, the vessels, will be brought to Babylon. Vishama Yihyu, and that's where they're going to stay. Ad Shuvah Hashem, until Hashem's anger abates. So the vessels are, you know, we're told by Yirmiyahu, they're going to Babel. They go to Babel. They are put with the Avodah Zarah in Nebuchadnezzar's trophy house. They are taken out and used, sort of the nadir of the Jewish experience. Your God, the vessels you use to serve your God are now going to be used at some pagan party. And then the ark turns the other way. Koresh returns them to the Jews so that they can use them in the second Beis HaMikdash. Right, so how come Koresh is so nice? It's a really good question for Sefer Ezra. And the answer is, he wasn't just nice to us. There was a long period of time when historians doubted the story of Koresh returning the vessels. They said, and the whole story of him sending us back and all that, they thought this was just Jews, you know, writing their history in some way that's going to appeal to them, and the Jews made it up and all that. And then they found what's called a cylinder, with his decree actually written on it from those
days. Want to ask their son?
So that's a whole other question of who exactly Koresh is and who Daryavish is, and we may have to deal with that actually for the next parak in Daniel. But no, Koresh is not Esther's son. Yes. That we do know because he's pre-Purim.
You know, Jewish people are named Koresh.
Persons. Yes, I had in school. I had someone I was in school with. There were twins named Cyrus and Darius.
Yeah,
their last name was Schwartz. Cyrus and Darius Schwartz. Yes. So anyway, but in terms of why Koresh did this, he did this not just for the Jews. He did this in general for the people under his control. He was a believer in the idea that as long as you were loyal to the Persian Empire, meaning you paid taxes to the Persian Empire, you could worship as you choose and live as you choose. Yeah, that was his approach. And not only that, you'll see in Sefer Ezra, he bankrolled the second Beis HaMikdash. It wasn't just that he said, you can go back and good luck, but he actually funded it. So there's a lot to be said. The Gemara in the beginning of Rosh Hashanah discusses this because of a question. They want to know, do we view Koresh as a good king or a bad king? It has to do with some of the chronology issues in listing what month things happened, what year things happened, what came first, what came second, because for kings who are deemed not kosher, so to speak, they count their years from Tishrei. For kings, for Jewish kings, then they count from Nisan. And for Koresh, it looks like they're counting from Nisan at one point. And the question is, why? Is it because we view him as being such a great king that we'll do that? That's in the beginning of Rosh Hashanah. But Koresh returns the Kalim, which is very nice of him. But I think this is also meant to display the arc of the Jewish people's experience in their exile and after the loss of the Beis Hamikdash, meaning the Kalim represent our connection to God. This is what we used when we were able to have a Beis Hamikdash, when we were able to communicate with Hashem. They went into exile. Hashem said, my connection with you is going to be in exile until things change. And then it hits rock bottom in Belshazzar's feast before Hashem says, okay, enough. Now it's time for this to end and you're going to be able to return and things will be restored. That's the arc represented here. Clear? Mm-hmm. Okay. So that is, that's it for Belshazzar, obviously. And then you get, in the beginning of the sixth parak, I'm just check on how we're doing on time. Oh, that's the answer. Okay, so the sixth parak will have to be for next time, and we'll have to learn about the role of the Medes at that point. See you.